Thank you. Great pleasure to be here. Can everybody hear me okay? Is the volume about right? Okay. Sorry. Yeah. If it's too loud, please just tell me to calm down, because I can get excited. So I'd like to thank you, Lisa and Elizabeth and everyone else at the center for inviting me here. It's been about 20 years since I've attended a BU event, so great fun to be here, especially as a speaker. So the main argument I want to present today is that pluralism can promote the progress of science. In doing so, I'll be going against the very common notion that there is only one truth about nature and ultimately one best scientific theory which expresses that truth. It's generally admitted, okay, science has not yet reached the one truth theory, but there is a widely shared optimism that we are making steady progress toward such an ideal state of science. Maybe that optimism is not shared in this room, I don't know, but it's out there, right? This progress consists in each field of study producing better and better theories, and also different fields becoming unified with each other. Physicists, especially, have often spoken of finding a grand unified theory, and also expressed the view that ultimately all science can be reduced to elementary particle physics. For example, Steven Weinberg, we had the other Weinberg earlier today, Steven Weinberg, this is, famously express what he called the dreams of a final theory, one that would be of unlimited validity and entirely satisfying in its completeness and consistency. In fact, when 21 years ago I was last at a Boston Colloquium event, there was Steven Weinberg speaking in just those tones. I can reminisce about that more if you want. And then, more infamously, here's Ernest Rutherford, who allegedly declared that all science is either physics or is just stamp collecting. As appropriate punishment for this, they gave him the Nobel Prize in chemistry. This kind of view is commonly referred to as monism, and I will define that term more precisely in just a minute. Against monism, I propose pluralism. What exactly that means, I will also define more precisely. But for the moment, the basic pluralist intuition is that the progress of science is actually helped by the presence of multiple theories and multiple methodologies, even within one field of science. Each approach would make its own distinct contributions to knowledge, and the different approaches can also interact productively with each other. Science has often benefited from such plurality, and I think it would be helped by more plurality. So what I'd like to do in the main part of this talk is present to you a brief yet systematic case in favor of this pluralism, describing its benefits and considering its risks. The details of these arguments are in my recent book, which Elisa kindly mentioned. I, by the way, have only two books, so several was a slight exaggeration. It's in the last chapter of this book, but today I want to just give you the highlights, because that's what we can do in 45 minutes. There's a lesson I learned from Peter Lipton, my predecessor at Cambridge, who unfortunately passed away in his early 50s. Which is that any significant philosophical point can be expressed in an appropriate joke. So here's one for pluralism as well. It's a brief exchange between a teacher and a pupil. So the teacher tells the student, "Your composition on my dog is exactly the same as your brother's. Did you copy his?" And the student indignantly replies, "No, sir, it's the same dog." We laugh about this. I'm glad you did. But when it comes to science, we tend to be very wary of the idea that there may be more than one valid and cogent account that one can give of one and the same object or an object domain. So my dream is not of a final theory, but that one day we will be able to tell this same joke about science. In the next 40 minutes or so, I hope to spell out the point that in science too, there may be more than one valid and cogent account one can give of one and the same object, and that science can progress better by cultivating such multiple accounts. Now I would like to present more systematic arguments, as promised, in support of pluralism. My arguments are going to be general and abstract, which, if you know my work, is very unusual. I'm usually deeply into a specific case, but sometimes I think you have to give an abstract general formulation, so that's what I'm going to try to do today. Still, I'm going to try to give brief references to various examples from scientific practice. Now, as you'll be able to tell my examples, the sciences that I know best are physics and chemistry, and I hope that my focus on the physical sciences here will actually nicely complement the biomedical and behavioral focus of Professor Smith and Professor Putinsky's presentations in a useful way. So let me start by giving you more precise definitions of monism and pluralism, again, as promised. Anya has already mentioned this volume by Kellert, Longino, and Waters. They give a nice definition of scientific monism, right? Note especially here, points 1, 4, and 5. One says, the ultimate aim of a science is to establish a single, complete, and comprehensive account of the natural world, or the part of the world investigated by the given science, based on a single set of fundamental principles. Item 4 says, methods of inquiry are to be accepted on the basis of whether they can yield such an account, as mentioned in 1. And 5, individual theories and models in science are to be evaluated in large part on the basis of whether they can provide such an account. I would counter this monistic position in 2 steps. First of all, what science should do is give an account of the natural world that serves whatever ultimate aims that we may have. The monistic character of the account of nature should not in itself be our ultimate aim. Secondly, I believe that the standard aims of science can be served better if we have multiple accounts of each given domain of nature. Now, what an account means here is not very precise. I think for Kellert, Longino, and Waters, an account of nature is basically a theory, at best a model. But I think we need to think in broader terms when we are trying to have a full picture of scientific practice. So instead of an account or a theory, I'll speak in terms of what I call a system of practice, by which I mean a coherent and interacting set of epistemic activities performed with a view to achieve certain overall aims. An epistemic activity, in turn, is a coherent set of mental or physical operations that are intended to contribute to the production or improvement of knowledge in a particular way, in accordance with some discernible rules. There are many diverse kinds of epistemic activities, ranging from, say, solving equations to taking measurements. By speaking of activities and systems, I also don't mean to disregard theories, because each scientific system of practice, of course, also embodies theories about the aspect of reality that constitutes its subject area. So the core of pluralism that I advocate is a commitment to foster multiple systems of practice in each area of scientific inquiry. The demand for plurality is the most crucial feature of pluralism. Now that probably sounds like a stupid point, but it needs to be stressed, as you will see later. We'll come back to that one. Pluralism is about the benefits of actually having multiple systems in coexistence. So my slogan for pluralism would not be the anything goes of Paul Feyerabend, rather many things go. Now, that's enough definitions. You're probably bored already. So, having stated my position, let me now get on with its defense. There are two broad categories of benefits of plurality, which I call benefits of toleration and benefits of interaction. And accordingly, there are also two different categories of pluralism focused on achieving each kind of benefit. So the main feature of tolerant pluralism is quite simply to allow different systems to coexist with respect and toleration for each other. The benefits of toleration could even be achieved by having competing monist individuals or subgroups. Going further than that, interactive pluralism also seeks benefits from having different systems of knowledge interact with each other, rather than standing separately and delivering separate sets of contributions. If the slogan for tolerant pluralism is the proverbial "let 100 flowers bloom," interactive pluralism says, yes, let them all bloom, but also cross-fertilize. The benefits of interaction can only be realized if additional conditions are met. At least some of the parties involved need to be pluralist in their outlook so that they are willing to engage with others in a productive way. And then some level of common language is also required to allow communication. I can elaborate on those points more if you would like. Now, so that's the general picture. Let me elucidate these benefits of plurality in some more detail now. There are different types of benefits of toleration appropriate for various different purposes. First, given the uncertainty about the course of future scientific development, it makes sense to keep multiple lines of inquiry open. This argument applies almost regardless of what one's ultimate aim is, but I'm particularly concerned to show, first of all, that pluralism is more productive than monism, even for those people who follow the common realist conception that science has only one ultimate aim, and that this aim is truth, with a capital T, which is objective and univocal. So even for those extreme realist monists, I'm going to argue pluralism is the better course of action. Why? Well, the history of scientific progress shows that today's favored path may not remain the most promising one tomorrow. This is a familiar point, right? Larry Loudon's pessimistic meta-induction from the history of science does pretty well point out the basic insecurity of our theoretical positions in science. More recently, Kyle Stanford's so-called problem of unconceived alternatives has the same disturbing effect on any alleged security about theory choice. The unpredictability about the direction of scientific development was already emphasized by Kuhn, like many things. For example, in cosmology, Kuhn says there has been no clear direction of development as scientists moved from the closed and spherical Aristotelian universe to the open and infinite Newtonian universe, and then to the closed four-dimensional curved space-time of modern cosmology. What next? The amazing success of Newtonian mechanics was no guarantee that the subsequent best approach to truth would not lie in an entirely different line of inquiry. That is completely compatible with acknowledging that the numerical success of Newtonian mechanics still remains. Faced with an insurmountable unpredictability, what should rational agents do? It's clear that we should hedge our bets, or avoid putting all of our eggs in one basket, or whatever idiom you prefer. Given that we do not know which line of inquiry will ultimately lead to the truth, we should keep multiple lines open. Instead of pursuing one line faithfully to its dead end, only then to try a different one. Where I disagree with Kuhn. To put it in Bayesian terms, if you prefer, all theories with non-negligible prior probabilities should be monitored for signs of life. That is, incipient increases in posterior probabilities as further evidence comes in. It is most irrational to insist that only the theory with the highest probability at the moment should be preserved and all others eliminated. Now, not everyone thinks that truth with a capital T is the ultimate aim of science. And if we look at the here and now of science, ultimate truth is not even an operable aim at all, because we can never be sure whether we have got the truth or even if we are approaching it. Instead, we pursue aims whose achievement we can actually judge as we go on, and ideals towards which we can strive, knowing whether or not we are getting closer to them. When we consider the ongoing satisfaction of scientific aims, there are further arguments for pluralism in addition to that arising from the unpredictability of future development. So it's the second one now, which I've called division of labor, a little bit with Philip Kitcher in mind when he goes on about the division of cognitive labor. Right? One obvious argument for pluralism is that different systems may fulfill a given aim partially, so that jointly they serve the aim more completely than each one can. This kind of division of labor is very easily observed, for example, in relation to empirical adequacy. At the larger scale, we have a division of labor between different sciences. And then even within a given field of science, different systems, even mutually incommensurable ones, are used simultaneously to cover different phenomena or different aspects of the same phenomena. So if our best theory covers only some of the known phenomena, then we need to have other ones that cover the rest. Scientific development proceeds in this pluralistic pattern more often than people usually realize. For example, it's a myth that classical mechanics is no longer necessary in principle because it has been reduced to quantum mechanics and relativity. We still need classical mechanics to handle what was always its domain, and this is not just a matter of practical convenience or computing power. We actually cannot set up in any sensible form the Schrödinger equation or the Einstein field equation for macroscopic rigid bodies. So it makes sense that modern physicists actually have retained classical mechanics with its various branches, and also special relativity, general relativity, ordinary quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, and beyond. I mean, we have to ask, why do physicists torture every freshman with Newtonian mechanics if it's just wrong and an approximate solution to the better things we have? In any empiricist regime of science in which the ability to account for observations is chiefly prized, there is a pluralist need for a division of labor. Now, more generally speaking, there is a need for such division of labor in relation to any aim whose satisfaction may come piecemeal or be achieved to different degrees in different places. For example, different idealized models may provide good intuitive understanding in different domains where no single model can provide it everywhere. Different measurement methods may deliver high precision at different points on the scale of a quantity. This is why, for example, the international practical scale of temperature is a patchwork of different standards. And different approximations may deliver the most simplicity in different domains. In all of these cases, our aims can best be satisfied overall by maintaining multiple systems, each of which works well within a limited domain. Now, so far I've discussed A and B, the benefits of plurality in satisfying any given aim of science. Add to that the fact that people have different aims, and each of us may have multiple aims too. Then the case for pluralism becomes even stronger. There is no convincing reason to think that science has only one overriding value or aim. In addition to empirical adequacy, Bas van Frassen gave us a whole list of pragmatic virtues, as he called them, including elegance, explanatory power, and simplicity, and so on. And I don't think he gave a convincing reason for regarding these as secondary in importance to empirical adequacy. While Kuhn sometimes privileged problem-solving ability as the key value in science, he also gave us a whole list of other important values: accuracy, simplicity, consistency, scope, and fruitfulness. Once we grant that there are multiple human needs that science is called upon to satisfy, it is easy to recognize that we will most likely not be able to come up with the perfect system that satisfies all needs. And even if people ostensibly share the same stated aim, it may be that they have such different criteria for judging when the aim has been fulfilled that they might as well be pursuing different aims. For example, different people will derive understanding from different types or systems of knowledge. Right? As Pierre Duhem infamously put it, the ample and shallow mind of the English physicist could only understand something if a mechanical model could be made of it. Meanwhile, the deep mind of the French physicist derived all the necessary understanding from formal mathematical systems, with no need for childish models involving gears and pulleys and tubes of fluids. But if the overall aim of science is the greatest understanding by the greatest number of people, including even the English ones, then pluralism is the inevitable conclusion, since no single system will be able to provide satisfactory intuitive understanding to everyone. So far, A, B, and C, my arguments for plurality have all been based on some sort of limitation on the part of human inquirers. For example, our inability to predict the future course of scientific development, or the limited applicability of our systems of knowledge, or our inability to craft a perfect system of magical system satisfying all of our needs. Now I want to add a more exuberant and less defensive argument, whose main point is that plurality enriches knowledge. Even when one system can serve our aims fully, other systems may also be able to serve the same aims in new ways. Such epistemic exuberance, abundance, should delight us. Even if our aim is true, and even if we have attained it, we can still wish for more. Why should science end when we have one complete and true theory of the universe? We can try to make another one. If you have one perfect child, should you never have another? You might say, I only say that because I don't have children. One is enough, right? Who says that two truths about the same subject matter have to be exactly equivalent to each other? All that logic requires is that two true theories do not directly contradict each other. We can enjoy pluralist abundance in scientific understanding. This is not just a matter of different people having different preferences, or what Thomas Beddoes called taste in world making. In a mature state of science, one and the same person can appreciate and enjoy different types of understanding drawn from different systems. So personally, I like knowing how to frame and solve the same problem in Newtonian, Lagrangian, Hamiltonian, and Hertzian formulations of mechanics. I don't actually remember how to do that anymore, but I used to really enjoy that. I want both teleological and mechanistic accounts of the same phenomenon, whether it be the propagation of light or the development of embryos. It delights me to learn that the phlogiston theory could explain all the chemical phenomena that Lavoisier explained, and that Kepler's laws of planetary motion could be derived from a version of Descartes' vortex theory, and so on. That delight does not come from abandoning Lavoisier's and Newton's theories, but from learning additional ways of making sense of things. So give me the Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Feynman, and Bohm versions of quantum mechanics. These are so many different ways of appreciating the physical world. so many more windows on nature, a more enriched understanding of it. Why is this any worse or better than having galleries full of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ depicted in so many different ways by so many wonderful artists? In general, even if we have a system of practice that satisfies a certain aim quite well, we can always benefit from another system that satisfies the same aim in a different manner. So far I've explored the benefits of a mere toleration of plurality. Toleration allows various systems of practice each pursue its various aims in its own way. These benefits are significant. However, the full force of pluralism can only be appreciated if we also consider the benefits arising from the interaction of different systems with each other. This is a point on which my former student Sabina Leonelli just pushed me until I gave up and said, okay, I'll think about it. And that was a very good thing. Charles Sanders Peirce had a wonderful metaphor for extolling the strength of, quote, a cable whose fibers may be ever so slender, provided they are sufficiently numerous and intimately connected. As Peirce pointed out, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Better than a chain, what I call tolerant pluralism is like a bundle of strings, which is as strong as its strongest strand. But better than that even, a cable or a rope is actually stronger than its strongest strand due to the productive interaction between the strands. This gives us quite a perfect image for interactive pluralism. There are again different types of benefits of interaction arising from different types of interaction. And this will come back to some of the discussions we were having earlier this afternoon. So I'm going to outline three different types here. Integration, which we have been speaking about, right? Other authors have already articulated one key aspect of interactive pluralism in quite some detail, but I want to pull them together here. There are situations in which not any one of the available systems by itself, not even all of them additively, can achieve a certain aim. In such cases, we may attempt to reach a better result by an ad hoc integration of different systems. This integration is by definition ad hoc, because if it weren't, then we would have a unified system rather than a pluralistic integration of different systems. Sandra Mitchell actually, right, calls her doctrine integrative pluralism. She spells out in detail this kind of benefit, especially considering complex biological systems, such as communities of social insects, whose great complexity precludes monistic explanations. In the realm of physics, we have a wonderful example of this from Elisa Boklitsch's investigation of semi-classical physics. Hello. Which rests on what she calls a thorough hybridization of classical and quantum ideas. And I think what I'm trying to articulate here has a lot to do with what Elisa calls interstructuralism. I regret I don't have time to go into the full details, but you can corner her anytime you want. And this also gives me the perfect opportunity to express a regret that I only came across that work of Elisa's after I finished writing my H2O book. So my discussion of pluralism doesn't refer to her work, and I'm really sorry about it. Okay. Similar and more familiar perhaps to most people these days is the example of the global positioning system, GPS, which underlies our familiar navigation systems these days, right? What is this example? Well, how do we make the GPS system? Some of you know this already, others don't. So I've given you a picture. what we have to do is shoot a whole bunch of satellites, which maintain their positions, and then we put an atomic clock on each of those satellites. Right? Then, to determine the position of each given point on Earth, there would be three or four satellites that each sends a signal and measures the amount of time it takes for the signal to come back, and then they basically triangulate between themselves. And in order to do this, you have to really integrate many different theories of physics. So doing the satellite shooting relies on Newtonian mechanics. We all know that. The atomic clocks have to be operated with quantum mechanics, and then they have to be corrected using both special and general relativity, right, to account for the variations in their rate, first according to the speed at which the satellites they are riding are moving, and to account for the variations arising from the position of the satellites in the gravitational field of the Earth. And then the signals come down to your navigator, and you think the Earth is flat as you walk around. Right. So everything from pre-modern astronomy to general relativity is brought together in this wonderfully accurate system of navigation. And we could not just achieve this by sitting there with a pipe dream of one grand unified theory of GPS which does all of the jobs. This is similar to Otto Neurath's modest recipe for the unity of science, which recognizes the existing disunity in science, but insists on what he calls unity at the point of action. So he has a wonderful example of putting out a forest fire, for which you need to understand not only the physics and chemistry involved in the combustion of the thing, but you have to understand the biology of the trees, the ecology of the whole forest. You have to have some sociology with which to organize the fire brigade, and then you have to have some economics to be able to finance it. It all needs to be brought together at the point of action. Peter Galison's intercalated picture of physics, as he puts it, gives a similar message. Invoking Peirce's cable metaphor, actually, Galison argues that the strength of modern physics lies in its composition from independent strands of theory, experiment, and instrumentation, each of which develops with its own internal dynamics. At each point in time, the integration between the strands has to be worked out anew. So that's integration. But even if there is no full integration of the kind I've been speaking about, different systems of knowledge can still benefit from each other. Various types of elements may be co-opted from another system of knowledge to help achieve one's own aims. Empirical results, theoretical ideas, mathematical techniques, instruments, or materials even. This can happen without direction from the top or even any two-way communication. For example, Lavoisier only achieved what he achieved by co-opting various results and techniques from the phlogiston chemists. Priestley showed him how to make oxygen. Cavendish told him that he could make water by burning hydrogen, etc. What was wrong with Lavoisier was not acknowledging the debt to these people, not the fact that he co-opted these elements usefully for his own work. That was absolutely a legit way of doing science. Now, you may ask why elements of knowledge would need to be co-opted from another system rather than created within one's own. The general answer is that each system develops under certain constraints, which may actually prevent the production of elements that would help its own progress most effectively. Economically speaking, this is why we trade. You might say, why don't we be like North Korea? Well, you know why. They try to produce everything within their own country. Even if there's neither integration nor co-optation, there can be a productive relationship between coexisting systems of practice, namely competition. Something else we already spoke about this afternoon. Now, philosophers of science have often spoken about the competition between theories or paradigms or research programs. but they've done it merely as a tally of the accomplishments of each system achieved in total isolation from the others. Real-life competition is an interactive process in which competitors actually influence each other's behavior. That is the case in science as much as it is in sports or in the economy. So in the economic realm, what capitalists hold sacrosanct is the positive effect of competition in maximizing efficiency. This comes, for example, from firms wanting to cut prices in order to attract more customers. That's not even economics 101, but I think even that crude level of thinking would offer an improvement on the usual philosophical discourse on competition in science. How does competition affect scientific behavior? When you think about that seriously, there is no simple story here. Because what scientists want is not simple. It may be fame and prestige. It may be better research facilities and bigger research teams. It may be a secure teaching job. It may be money. Or it may actually be the satisfaction of problem solving and understanding. In practice, much of this is acquired through the production of useful results or attractive ideas that are impressive, right? Impressive to one's peers, to the next generation of scholars, and sometimes even to the general public. Why am I making that point? Because in the context of the debate on pluralism and monism, the interesting thing is how having a plurality of systems around affects what is considered impressive. In a monistic context such as Kuhnian normal science, attention and creativity will be focused on a small number of agreed-upon cutting-edge problems, and only a narrow range of types of solutions will be prized. It will be easy to suppress or neglect those who favor different types of solutions or pursue different problems altogether, because the choice for them will be either to give up their preferences or to leave science altogether. The kind of cases we see time and again, for example, in Evelyn Fox Keller's portrayal of Barbara McClintock. In a pluralistic regime, the presence of competing systems will make it much harder to make people toe the line in this way. Even the practitioners of a dominant system will need to work harder at justifying their own approach and selling it to funders, students, and potential collaborators. So, a genuine competition between multiple systems of practice within a scientific field can have a liberating and stimulating effect on the progress of science. And it is important not to be hasty and drastic in the removal of systems that aren't doing very well. If ruthless competition ends up in a monopoly by the winner, that defeats the whole purpose of competition. The benefits of competition can be maintained only when there is competition. If we eliminate all the losers, we also need to ensure that there's a mechanism by which new competitors can take their places to keep the competition going. Now, I've been selling pluralism. You probably agree with many of the points I've made. You probably also have various worries, which I'm going to now try to anticipate and address. So that's the last substantive part of my talk. Having listed various benefits of plurality, I cannot complete my assessment without considering some potential harms or risks. Foremost in the mind of traditional philosophers and orthodox scientists, if there are any in this room, will be a worry that pluralism will produce a relativist chaos in which the voices of reason and science are drowned out by a cacophony of quacks, charlatans, religious fundamentalists, New Age mystics, and just plain idiots. This chaos would result in all kinds of problems. Perhaps worst of all, without social authority vested in proper science, the relativist chaos may settle into the nightmare of one crazy faction taking epistemic power and imposing itself on the rest of society. We are still less than a century away from the horrors of so-called Aryan physics in Germany and Lysenkoism in the Soviet Union. And scientists today worry about creationists or climate change deniers becoming dominant. Pluralism, they worry, could play paradoxically into the hands of extremists, undermining benign monism only to replace it with perverse monism. In response to this worry, I need to emphasize very strongly the distinction between pluralism and relativism. Pluralism takes a stance against absolutism in a way that relativism actually cannot. A system of knowledge that denies the rights of other systems to exist would have to be banned in a pluralistic system of science. That doesn't sound very pluralist, but this is necessary. Just as a truly free society needs to impose constraints on individuals and groups to prevent them from restricting the freedom of others. Furthermore, pluralism requires that there should actually be multiple systems of knowledge simultaneously in a given domain. Again, the demand for plurality is an essential feature of pluralism. An obvious point, but it's very important to keep it in mind. Curiously, this kind of plurality is not required by relativism if it only insists on the equal treatment of any alternatives that do exist. So if everybody decides to choose the same thing, like Hitler, the relativist has no principled way of opposing that. Pluralism is about the benefits of actually having multiple systems in coexistence. Remember, not anything goes, but many things go. But how about the relativist chaos itself, which may be well-intentioned but still seriously counterproductive? That has to be prevented in some way. To use a metaphor that Sandy Mitchell, when I gave this talk in Pittsburgh, has put into my head, how does a pluralist decide who gets to come to the table? Shouldn't we have a firm set of criteria to determine who deserves research funding, university posts, space in academic journals, the right to teach children, and even access to the public? Often people become unhappy because pluralism in itself is not able to give an answer to this question. But this unhappiness, I maintain, is based on a category mistake. Because pluralism is a doctrine about the number of places we should have at the table. It cannot answer a wholly different question, namely, the guest list. More specifically, pluralism is based on a worry about eating alone and recommends that it is better to have more than one place at the table. In a different analogy, deciding that we want a multi-party democracy does not determine which parties will be legal, not to mention which of the legal ones will win in a given election. But the objection keeps returning. It's like a bad itch. It won't go away. If you go with pluralism, how do you choose what to believe? Well, how do you choose what to believe? Do whatever you do in choosing the winner in a monist scheme, and then just pick two winners at the end. Or put in a second prize. That would be a fine start for pluralism. Pick three winners if you can afford to have a third prize. If all this seems intolerably inadequate, it is good to remind ourselves that monism in itself does not specify the criteria of choice either. Deciding that there'll be only one place at the table does not determine who gets to sit there. Me, of course, is the usual unspoken assumption. But it should be plain that neither pluralism nor monism determines very much about what we should believe in science, or even how we should decide what to believe. I have my views about how to make those decisions, but that is a different issue and a different talk. If the first two worries on this list are based on a misunderstanding of pluralism, the third is a genuine worry. This objection, congenial to Kuhn's view of normal science, starts with an observation about human psychology. Scientists can only focus down on esoteric questions if they're not unduly distracted. And monism is the best mindset for this activity. Now, this is a valid point, at least about some people's psychology. and it poses a difficulty for putting interactive pluralism into practice. However, I don't think that it's a universal and immutable feature of human psychology. Just as people can grow up multilingual and learn to multitask, people can also learn to do focused work while entertaining other ways of thinking. In any case, it's fine for tolerant pluralism, at least if individuals or groups pursuing their own systems of knowledge are monists at heart, as long as no one interferes with others pursuing their own schemes. That way, all the benefits of Kuhnian normal science can be had within each paradigm while we allow multiple paradigms. The last worry I'm going to address is cost. Can we afford it all? We know scientific research requires a great deal of time, money, and talent, and not all possible lines of inquiry can be supported. So don't we need to pool resources into one line of inquiry in each field? I have three layers of responses to this worry. First, in the modern era, science is not so under-resourced, despite the continual protest by scientists themselves. Surely there are enough resources to go beyond the strict monopoly. The question is just how pluralistic can we afford to go? And it may not take a great deal of resources to keep ideas and lines of inquiry alive. James Lovelock, the author of the Gaia hypothesis, you may recognize, once asked for just 1% of the national science budget to be given to all the unorthodox schemes. Just 1% for the crazy people. You still have the 99, but something may come of it. There are also points of diminishing return. I think modern scientists have actually tended to put too much investment into monopolistic lines of thinking. Have we, for example, got a good return on our investment by putting so much of the best talent in theoretical physics in recent decades into string theory? Or advance the health of people best by focusing so much on synthetic pharmaceuticals? Having too many people trying the same fashionable approach can be wasteful. Finally, it's a pessimistic fallacy to assume that the amount of resources that society devotes to science will remain the same. If we inspire people, we will increase the number of people going into science and even the amount of funding. So let me now conclude briefly, maybe not as briefly as you want, but it will be brief. My arguments for pluralism are ultimately based on a sense of humility concerning human knowledge. In the early days, many scientists had the confidence and arrogance typical of ambitious youth, believing that a simple truth applying to all of nature would be revealed to the appropriate genius. You may trace this attitude all the way back to Thales declaring that everything was made of water, or Aristotle identifying four basic elements. Such aspirations were given great encouragement by later successes such as Newton's law of gravitation, universal gravitation. But I think over the centuries, scientists have also learned a more pragmatic and useful lesson, which is that for most purposes, we can learn more about nature by devising concepts and methods of inquiry that are suited specifically for particular domains of phenomena. So more mature than the dreams of a final theory, I believe, is the recognition that it is not likely that we will find a one-size-fits-all solution to all scientific problems. I'm going to leave you with a picture, which comes from Joseph Priestley, who more than 200 years ago expressed a very wise perspective on scientific progress. He said, "Every discovery brings to our view many things of which we had no intimation before." He had a wonderful image for this, which says, "The greater is the circle of light, the greater is the boundary of the darkness by which it is confined." So I made a picture. Is knowledge as a bright circle in the vast darkness? And that knowledge will grow and see what happens. As knowledge grows, so does ignorance. It's the kind of ignorance that are tractable. These are the research questions. These are things we would like to know but don't know yet. In the vast darkness here is Donald Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. We don't even know how to ask about So you might get depressed thinking, what's the point of knowing if the more we know, the more ignorance we get? But Priestley was optimistic about this. He continued, but notwithstanding this, the more light we get, the more thankful we ought to be. For by this means we have the greater range for satisfactory contemplation. In time, the bounds of light will be still farther extended, and from the infinity of the divine nature and the divine works, we may promise ourselves an endless progress in our investigation of them, a prospect truly sublime and glorious. Priestley, appropriately named, was a preacher as well as a scientist, and his view was based on his conception of God. But if we're not religious, all we need to share with Priestley in order to appreciate his insight is some reasonable humility concerning human abilities, or recognition of the complexity of the universe, or both. So with some basic epistemic humility, it is easy to recognize that no system of knowledge in science should be given the right to suppress, exclude, or delegitimize all others, because we need as many systems as we can afford to maintain in order to give ourselves maximal exposure to reality. The knowledge gained by such maximal exposure to reality also contributes to the full actualization of the human potential. After many centuries of struggle, we have learned to accept and benefit from such a spirit of pluralism in the realms of politics, culture, language, cuisine, art, and ecology. I believe it is time to welcome it in science too. Thank you very much.